This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 7th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. As Ariel Sharon heads back to Israel after meetings with President Bush, the negotiations at the Church of the Nativity stall, with over 100 still stranded inside. Dutch far-right candidate is assassinated, but the Dutch general elections will go ahead. And Free Speech Radio News visits the capital of Sierra Leone ahead of the upcoming presidential elections to see how the city is being regenerated in the aftermath of many years of civil war. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The FBI has released an all-points bulletin for 22-year-old male University of Wisconsin college student in connection with the mailbox pipe bomb case.
And I realize that you have a lot of questions about this, and I understand this, but the investigation continues, and at this stage, we need to talk to Luke Helder, and we need to try to resolve this aspect of this investigation.
The alert comes just after another pipe bomb was found in an Amarillo, Texas mailbox earlier today. Government officials say the 17 found bombs were likely to have been the work of one person. Janicki Lafice has more on the bombs found in Colorado from KGNU in Boulder.
The pipe bomb threat, considered by the FBI to be domestic terrorism, has moved to the Southwest. A 6-inch pipe bomb wrapped in a plastic baggie was found yesterday in a mailbox in Salida, Colorado. Walt Iams, a 31-year resident of this quiet mountain town located 150 miles southwest of Denver, opened his mailbox, recognized what might be a bomb, and immediately called 911. Another bomb was found in Amarillo, Texas this morning, following a pattern of 15 other bombs left in Iowa, Illinois, and Nebraska. 6 of these bombs have exploded, injuring 4 postal workers and 2 elderly people. Notes left with the bombs complained about the disparity between the rich and the poor in the U.S. and about the government's control of the people. The bag in Salida also contained a note, but authorities have not yet revealed its contents. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Janicki Lafice in Boulder, Colorado.
Federal regulators have released what some are calling a smoking gun memo, proving illegal activity by Enron during California's energy crisis. Aaron Glantz reports from San Francisco.
The internal memo cites a practice Enron officials dubbed Death Star, designed to create the false appearance of congestion on power lines. The December 2000 memo said, quote, "The net effect of these transactions is that Enron gets paid for moving energy to relieve congestion without actually removing any energy or relieving any congestion."
They acknowledged very clearly that they were making money without making anything.
Doug Heller, senior advocate with the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights.
Enron and the power companies were using the deregulation law to create artificial shortages and jack up the prices of power.
Enron's annual profits nearly doubled as deregulation took effect, but it wasn't the only company. Energy giants like Duke, Reliant, and Dynergy continued to see record profits because of contracts they signed with the state during the power crisis. Now electric rates are up, and California faces a more than $20 billion budget deficit. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in San Francisco.
One Roman Catholic priest faced a judge today for alleged involvement in long-term sexual abuse of children. Chuck Rosina has more from Boston.
Former priest Paul Shanley was arraigned today in Cambridge District Court. He is charged with sexual molestation of several children over a 7-year period in the 1980s at St. Jean's Church in Newton, Massachusetts. Lynn Rooney, the Massachusetts state prosecutor, was concerned about Paul Shanley fleeing the country. Judge Diane Klein agreed, setting bail at $750,000 cash. And should Paul Shanley make bail, Judge Klein added these stipulations.
That you're to surrender your passport, that you're to remain in Massachusetts, that you're to have no contact with any child under 16, and to stay away from any alleged victim or witness in this case. Do you understand that, sir?
In related news, Cardinal Bernard Law, who allegedly protected Shanley and other priests accused of sexual foul play, has been ordered to give a deposition tomorrow. That deposition will remain in court custody, but it is likely that a transcript will be released. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
The United Nations General Assembly held an emergency meeting today. Hader Rizvi at the UN explains why.
The meeting was requested by South Africa as the head of non-aligned movement and Sudan, which leads the Arab League. Before the meeting, many Arab nations had complained about the decision of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to cancel a fact-finding mission to Jenin. The UN chief disbanded his mission only after Israel flatly refused to cooperate with the fact-finding team. UN spokesman Fred Eckhart was reluctant to say anything about the outcome of the General Assembly session this afternoon, but many believe it's very likely that the Assembly would ask the UN chief to produce a report on Jenin. According to UN officials, 35,000 people are in dire need of food in Jenin. The officials say more than 4,300 people have become homeless as a result of Israel's military aggression. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The UN General Assembly scheduled an emergency session today as a draft resolution introduced by Sudan on behalf of the Arab Group of Nations and by South Africa on behalf of the Non-Aligned Movement of Developing Countries would ask Secretary General Kofi Annan to submit a report on events in Jenin and other Palestinian cities within 2 weeks. This, as the Israeli military said today, that an end to the 36-day standoff at the Church of the Nativity was being delayed because no country was willing to take in 13 suspected Palestinian militants holed up in the shrine. Negotiators had said the preferred destination for the 13 was Italy. However, the Italian government complained that it had been largely kept out of the loop. International peace observer Kristen Scher is still inside the Church of the Nativity.
Many in the international community were led to believe that negotiations to end the Israeli siege on the Church of the Nativity had come to an end, but many aspects had not been closed and others had not yet been discussed. The number of Palestinians that Israelis say are wanted increased throughout last night. Men gathered round in the basilica as the lists of names were read. 26 for imprisonment in Gaza and the 6 to be exiled in Italy, up to 13. But Italy had not yet agreed to even let the Israeli plane land, reportedly commenting about the Palestinians that these people are not terrorists. And a man trapped inside the church for 37 days now said, there are no negotiations. The Israeli military plans to take all the Palestinians inside the church to an Israeli military camp outside Bethlehem for searching and interrogation, after which the list of the so-called wanted may increase. A man told me that it doesn't matter to him if he goes to prison or gets killed. He wants to be anywhere but here, trapped inside the church without food, electricity, proper water, or medical attention. The situation here is desperate. He said if an animal were starving, more people would care. It's going on 40 days without a proper meal for 123 Palestinians. Yesterday, we sat round a large metal dish of hot water mixed with a few bits of pasta for lunch. There was no breakfast or dinner. Many days there was nothing at all. This afternoon, I sat with a small group and boiled weeds picked from the ground in the courtyard. The limited international outrage at this humanitarian crisis has been largely ineffective. I have been under the threat of deportation for bringing food inside. After Palestinians complied with Israeli demands for a list of all those inside the church, I heard many stories of Israeli soldiers trashing their homes and hitting their fathers and sons. One man received word that Israeli soldiers bombed his home, destroying it completely. Last night, I sat up with a young Palestinian man, warming ourselves on candles burning in an old coffee can. He told me that Palestinians have to take this deal because their friends and families in the town of Bethlehem have not been able to work or to go to school in over a month. They cannot go to the shops most days because the curfew leaves them closed. And if a Palestinian is on the street during curfew, they are often shot. The entire town of Bethlehem has lived under Israeli siege for a month, a heightened form of the Israeli occupation that kills, humiliates, and destroys the lives of the Bethlehem area's 200,000 Palestinian residents. Israeli soldiers have made the Church of the Nativity a prison, yet leaving it is not safe either. Tanks have been driving around all day, as have APCs. And although the sniper crane was lowered, Israeli soldiers threw a concussion grenade just outside the stone perimeter, and snipers still inhabit all of the surrounding buildings. People are pacing up and down the basilica, looking thin and tired. Many don't get out of bed. Inspiration and hope Both line the faces of Palestinians who desire freedom more than food, even after 37 days without it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kristen Scherr, reporting from inside the Church of the Nativity, Bethlehem, Palestine.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is on his way back to the Middle East after meeting this afternoon with President Bush at the White House. The United States is trying to arrange a peace summit for the Middle East this summer, but Sharon says he'll only attend on the promise that Israel doesn't have to make any concessions to the Palestinians. And Sharon continues to refuse to deal with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. While Sharon's conditions are at odds with White House policy, President Bush is again pledging unflagging support for Israel. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
Prime Minister Sharon's Israeli government has resolutions of support from both houses of Congress and a strong ally in President Bush. In Washington, Sharon addressed the annual convention of the Anti-Defamation League. He's asking the American people for support of the Israeli occupation on the grounds the U.S. is doing the same thing in Afghanistan.
This fight against terrorism is morally and strategically justified anywhere in the world, whether in Afghanistan, Jenin, Shem, or as you call it, Nablus, the streets of Washington, or Jerusalem. There is a moral equivalency and direct connection between America's continuous operations against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Operation Defensive Shield. There are acts of self-defense against the same forces of evil and darkness bent on destroying civilized society.
To some extent, Sharon is right. The U.S. war in Afghanistan was something that was done unilaterally without going to international institutions. It was massive overkill.
Stephen Shalom says the parallel that Ariel Sharon draws between the so-called war on terrorism in Afghanistan and the Israeli occupation is appropriate. Shalom teaches political science at William Paterson University in New Jersey.
It was something that disregarded the well-being of civilians. Not that they, you know, aimed their bombs at civilians in Afghanistan, but despite warnings by so many aid workers and UN officials that there was a risk of massive starvation, U.S. officials essentially said, we don't care, we're willing to take that risk, it's only Afghan lives. And likewise, Israel has followed similar policies in the Palestinian territories. That is, I don't think they were aiming for as many to kill as many civilians as they could, but they certainly were indifferent.
Prime Minister Ariel Sharon continues to defend the Israeli army's conduct in Jenin, where the number of Palestinian civilian dead is still in dispute. Sharon says he's glad the United States could come to Israel's rescue and scuttle a UN fact-finding mission to the area. Jenin is the scene of what Palestinians call a massacre. Sharon says President Bush made sure Israeli soldiers wouldn't be subject to UN questioning. Sharon's visit to Washington was picketed by a couple hundred peace activists and Arab Americans waving Palestinian flags.
What's your name?
Michelle.
Are you a Jewish American? Are you an Arab American?
No, I'm nothing. I'm a socialist. I'm an internationalist.
What's your beef with Sharon?
Well, he's led a slaughter of the Jenin refugee camp, and he's covering it up now, and the U.S. is letting him get away with it. And there's not going to be any peace with Sharon.
Well, Sharon says the same thing about Arafat, that there's not going to be any peace with Arafat.
I actually don't think Arafat's a very effective leader. However, to put that on his shoulders is a huge mistake. Israel, from the onset, pushed out 750,000 Palestinians. They have ruled the West Bank and Gaza with brutality. I mean, the harassment, the checkpoints, the economic depravity that exists there.
Israel out of Palestine.
U.S. officials are trying to set up a peace conference for later this summer. They'll have to first do something to get Prime Minister Sharon to the table. So far, the White House has not been able to convince Sharon his war on terrorism is any different from its own. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The Dutch right-wing politician Pim Fortuyn was shot dead yesterday in the parking lot of a radio station in the central Dutch city of Hilversum. Fortuyn was shot 6 times and suffered multiple wounds in the head, chest and neck and died shortly afterwards. Fortuyn was a far-right candidate who provoked public indignation by calling the net for the Netherlands borders to be closed to immigrants and by describing Islam as a backward religion. He was bidding to be the country's first gay prime minister. After an emergency session, the Dutch government today announced that the scheduled May 15 national election for prime minister, for which Fortuyn was campaigning, would still go ahead. Politicians across Europe joined in condemning the assassination. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rupert Cook has been following the situation from Holland.
There are two particular areas to look at. Firstly, the fortunes of his party, which of course he founded only 3 months ago, and the Pim Fortuyn list. It had been expected to get between 19 and 36 seats in the 150-seat lower house of parliament. And obviously, because he was such a central figure to the party, there is the question of what will happen to his vote or the vote associated with him.
Rupert, the media has actually been reporting over here that he's a blend of right, far right and left, showing his gay rights platforms and his platform for women's rights to actually be much more liberal, yet he has these very anti-immigrant policies. Can you talk about that?
He's very interesting. People in the past have compared him to other figures in Europe who feature in this upsurge of the far right across Europe. For example, Jean-Marie Le Pen in France, and he's significantly different to Le Pen and to the National Front in France, or indeed the National Front in Britain. He's someone who is an openly homosexual politician, and his inspiration for launching his platform was supposedly based upon his anxiety that the culture of tolerance and liberalism in Holland, which is especially tolerant of homosexuality and a range of other minority groups, would be compromised by what he perceived as this influx of immigrants. And he essentially targeted Islam and the Muslim teachings, which he said were backward and would potentially change Dutch national culture. So in some ways, it was almost an intolerant form of tolerance or an authoritarian tolerance which he was espousing.
What impact do you think this will actually have? Because the elections now are coming up. Do you think this will in some way bring him or his party more votes?
I think that probably without him at the helm, without him at the head of his party, the vote for the Pim Fortuyn list will decrease, will go down, because he was such a charismatic and populist figure that they are rather leaderless without him. And the question is, where does the vote go? It's possible that the vote will go nowhere, because a lot of the people who voted for him or would have voted for him are supposedly people who normally don't vote anyway.
Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rupert Cook has been following the situation from Holland. While Congress is preparing to vote tomorrow on whether to override the Nevada government's veto of the nuclear waste storage facility at Yucca Mountain, people across the country have begun a campaign against the proposal. But in the area immediately surrounding Yucca Mountain, an area known as Nowe Segovia, the people's earth mother to the Western Shoshone people who live there, the opposition has been going on for years. Jenka Soderberg of the Independent Media Center has more from southeastern Nevada.
Each year, the Western Shoshone and their supporters gather at the Nevada test site on Mother's Day to demonstrate against the federal government's nuclear weapons testing and nuclear waste dumping on their land. Reinhard Knudsen is from the Shendahai Network, an advocacy group for the Western Shoshone.
Well, we've been doing protests at the test site since 1987. This is our fifth annual Mother's Day weekend gathering at the Nevada test site. Before that, we were traditionally doing it over the Easter weekend. So we've been out there maintaining a presence at the Nevada test site 1987.
With the Bush administration resuming subcritical nuclear tests after a 9-year moratorium and the pending House vote on the Yucca Mountain dump, the protest comes at a critical moment. Johnny Bob, a Western Shoshone elder and delegate from the Western Shoshone National Council, has organized a 6-day walk and run called Nue Segovia Nava Amia, Walk on the Sacred Land, around the test site and Sacred Mountain.
I'm out here to protect Mother Earth, protect our culture, protect our food, protect our birds, protect our deers, protect everything that Mother Nature gave us here on this land.
Knudsen of the Shendahai Network says that nuclear dumping on this land is particularly sensitive to the Western Shoshone. The Western Shoshone consider Yucca Mountain to be a sacred site. Currently, 15 Western Shoshone are circling the nuclear test site and Yucca Mountain, offering prayers to heal the land.
This group is made up of Western Shoshone who are demanding that the United States government close down the Nevada test site and stop all nuclear weapons programs, as well as cancel the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump. All these lands are within traditional Western Shoshone country called Niue Segovia, and the Western Shoshone National Council has declared their country to be a nuclear-free zone and is charging that the United States is violating Western Shoshone law by continuing with nuclear weapons testing programs and with continuing to plan on dumping nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain.
Hundreds more are expected to join the runners in time for the Mother's Day protest at the test site. Corbin Harney, Western Shoshone elder and founder of the Shundahai Network, says the run is important because it draws attention to the environmental dangers resulting from nuclear testing and waste.
Many, many people, many, many lives of animal life, bird life, creatures that crawl this Mother Earth have suffered under the hands of the nuclear energy. So we are here today. I hope that we can carry this message on out so that way we have the message out there how dangerous this nuclear waste is. They already began to ship this throughout the country. If it ever happens, any accident ever happens, that's going to affect our life 450-mile radius. What chance do we have to live 250,000 years? That's half life of a nuclear radiation. Think about it, you people.
I'm Jenka Soderberg of the Independent Media Center, reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Niue Segovia, Nevada.
Life in Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, has been traumatic over the past 10 years because of the civil war that raged in the West African nation. The city was captured twice by rebel forces, and both times countless buildings and homes were destroyed and the population terrorized. The war pitched the Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, rebels against government troops. The RUF said they were fighting to end corruption, but most observers say they were more interested in getting rich from the country's diamonds. Tens of thousands died in the conflict. But peace has returned to Sierra Leone, and Freetown is getting a new lease on life. Reporter Rory Mulholland visits the capital ahead of the presidential and parliamentary elections on May 14 to see how the city is being regenerated after the dark years of the war.
Henry Ferguson is the mayor of Freetown. He took me on a tour of the city to show me the extent of the devastation and what's being done to get things back to normal.
What's this church on our left
this
here?
This is the Holy Trinity Church. It was completely destroyed, completely vandalized, and was set on fire.
And tell me, when the rebels came, the last time they captured the city, the Revolutionary United Front, that was on January the 6th, 1999.
You are perfectly correct. And yes, indeed.
How long did they stay in town for?
They were here until the Ekomok people, entered.
That's and the local the city. West yeah. African peacekeeping
yes.
force.
This is another church called Truscott Church. Again, it was burnt. Now, this is a particularly interesting area. All the big buildings, all the huge buildings, were completely vandalized and destroyed, by the invaders. This is one you can see. Uh-huh. You can see another one. This is the church, which again is being rebuilt. At the moment, what we are trying to do is to give the city a facelift. With the united effort of the people, this city, out of the ashes of this destruction, we shall see a city that we shall all be proud of.
To achieve that city, more housing is being built, government buildings that were attacked by the rebels are being renovated, and the roads and electricity networks are being improved. About 60% of the reconstruction funds come from international donors, the rest from national incomes. But for the city to become economically stable in the long term, foreign investment is needed. I asked William Kuma of the Sierra Leone Chamber of Commerce if Freetown is now able to attract business from abroad.
Business is getting back on its feet slowly. Government is really assisting the private sector because that is what is considered as the engine of growth of the economy.
What sort of guarantees can you give foreign investors? I mean, Freetown, Sierra Leone has not been a safe place over the past 10 years by any means.
Well, the guarantees I can give foreign businesses is that the government is actually putting security as the number one priority. And I think this is the right or the best time to actually come and invest in Sierra Leone.
Stella.
Yes, Daddy.
You dare fall in love with an ordinary country boy whose parents are far below my social equals? You?
Daddy. Okay, cut. What I want you to do, I want you to make it a little bit forceful, but not too harsh.
John Solo is a playwright and director. He's currently directing a play called Forbidden Love.
After the peace accord was signed, people start coming to the theatre to watch plays. And so we're happy to have them back here because we've been doing all these drama activities to empty hall. But now people are coming in, enjoying themselves. So I can see after peace returns to Sierra Leone, people are very much happy again to watch plays. Okay.
But Daddy, there is a big problem.
Problem?
Yes, Dad.
What problem?
Daddy, I'm already pregnant.
What? Pregnant?
Most people I spoke to in Freetown agree with John Solo that the city is very definitely a happier, safer place than it was just a year or so ago.
When people go out at night, they go out to the movies, they dance, enjoy themselves. People stay out till the wee hours now, no problem.
Sierra Leone today is not the same as Sierra Leone 10 years ago. We have tremendous improvements in electricity supply, and the economic activities are booming again. I think everything is going on all right.
Freetown, his life is better. We're getting more houses. They're trying to build more houses and making some another business. The coffee is over. Now you can go any side. All the clubs are open.
Presently, until we see the election entirely peaceful and over, before ever somebody can determine the peacefulness of Freetown.
Well, I began my tour of the city with the mayor, Henry Ferguson, and it's with the mayor that my visit now comes to an end. We're on Lumley Beach on the edge of Freetown, and it is a most beautiful location and an inspiring location. So perhaps you could give me your final thoughts on the future of Freetown.
Three things at least would be my vision. A, good healthcare service. B, education for all those who want education. And three, better road construction so that people can move from place to place. But above all that, peace and stability. Because these are the two things, peace and stability, which will attract investors to this country.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rory Mulholland in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Deepa Fernandez.